Thank you, Morton. Morton and I are neighbors in Arlington, but I never see him except at gatherings like this in Milwaukee or Salt Lake City or San Diego. This is actually my first trip to Milwaukee, which, as we heard last night, has a proud tradition of progressivism, and we didn't hear quite as much about its tradition of socialism, but it's an interesting place to be talking about ownership. I want to start by talking about some stories from earliest American history. The settlers at Jamestown came as part of a company interest, and the settlers who first came there were, in effect, operating in a socialist environment. They were all supposed to pitch in and work together, and there would be a common store, and they had no individual interest in that, although, of course, they all assumed they would prosper from the prosperity of the enterprise. And based on this model, within 2 years, about three-quarters of them had died, and that period went down in history known as the starving time. Then Sir Thomas Dale arrived from England, looked over the situation, and instituted a measure of private property. And a leading historian of Virginia reports, as soon as the settlers were thrown upon their own resources, and each free man had acquired the right of owning property, the colonists quickly developed what became the distinguishing characteristic of Americans, an aptitude for all kinds of craftsmanship coupled with an innate genius for experimentation and invention. Notwithstanding the experience of Jamestown, a decade later in Plymouth, the same thing was tried. And there, I think you had both a corporate interest and a sort of Christian socialist, let us live as the early Christians did in common attitude. And according to William Bradford, who wrote the history of Plymouth Plantation, the experience that was had in this common course and condition tried sundry years, and that amongst godly and sober men may well evince the vanity of that conceit of Plato and other ancients, applauded by some of later times, that by taking away of property and bringing community into a commonwealth would make them happy and flourishing, as if they were wiser than God. For this community, so far as it was found to breed much confusion and discontent, and retard much employment that would have been to their benefit and comfort. For young men that were most able and fit for labor and service did repine that they should spend their time and strength to work for other men's wives and children without any recompense. This was thought injustice. Well, fortunately, William Bradford recognized the situation, instituted private property, and as he goes on to tell us in his history, instead of famine, now God gave them plenty. Now, virtually no one today believes in communism or the abolition of private property, but as Morton alluded to, there's still plenty of people who want to limit and regulate and impede private property, and our Supreme Court has just given the green light to one form of assault on private property. I was amused, and I hope I don't touch anyone particularly in this audience, but I was amused by some conservatives who referred to the Kelo decision as another example of judicial activism from the Supreme Court. It seems to me the Kelo decision was a failure to be activist on the part of the court. The court failed to strike down a state law that was in violation of the rights guaranteed in the Bill of Rights. Now, from my point of view, I might call that activism because I think it is judicial activism to find in the Constitution powers nowhere granted to government. But the usual critique of activism suggests that the Supreme Court take a more passive role, and in Kelo, that is exactly what they did with terrible consequences. Though it may yet prove to have good consequences as it has raised the understanding of the issue of private property across the country, and there may be some response. President Bush says he wants America to be an ownership society. What does that mean? I believe that an ownership society is a society of responsibility, liberty, and prosperity. Let me talk first about responsibility. We have known for a long time that people take better care of things they own. Aristotle wrote, "What belongs in common to the most people is accorded the least care. They take thought for their own things above all, and less about things common or only so much as falls to each individually. My colleague Tom Palmer, who has studied the roots of Western civilization a great deal, cites more of the historical roots of the ownership society. Aquinas observed in the Summa Theologica that property is necessary to human life, first, because every man is more careful to procure what is for himself alone than that which is common to many or to all, since each would shirk the labor and leave to another that which concerns the community, as happens where there is a great number of servants. Secondly, because human affairs are conducted in more orderly fashion if each man is charged with taking care of some particular thing himself. Thirdly, because a more peaceful state is ensured to man if each one is contented with his own. Quarrels arise more frequently where there is no division of the things possessed. In short, people take care of what is their own. Indeed, the concept of ownership is at the very heart of the notion of personal responsibility. We say that people own up to their acts. That is, they take possession, they take responsibility for their actions. Owners have the right to benefit from the proper use, wise use of their property, and they bear the consequences of unwise management. Not only are they more likely to care for what they own, but a system of property requires people to treat others with respect as well. Owners have the right to exclude other people from use of their property, and that requires me to ask you for permission, which tends to cause me to treat you with respect, whether you are a store owner, a private homeowner, or whatever. Now let me talk about liberty. Liberty and property are so intimately connected that John Locke saw society as founded on the mutual preservation of their lives, liberties, and estates, which I call by the general name property. James Madison directly connected property and rights, for, he said, as a man is said to have a right to his property, he may be equally said to have a property in his rights. Indeed, the terms property and rights are used virtually interchangeably during the founding period. One of the things we always remind advocates of the First Amendment is that without ownership of printing presses, paper and ink, or computers and servers and email accounts, there can be no free press. Without ownership of land and buildings, there can be no freedom of association, no freedom of common worship, no freedom of action generally. A free society is of necessity an ownership society, and we obviously see that in the history of the world. And third, prosperity. Ownership makes markets possible, and markets make prosperity possible. Incentives created by property inspire people to create value, precisely because they can capture that value. Further, ownership makes markets possible, and markets make prices possible, and prices make possible a higher degree of coordination of efforts than would be possible under any form of central direction. Without the prices made possible by the exchange of property by the rights owners, there are no signals to guide entrepreneurs to the best use of scarce resources or to coordinate large numbers of people in complicated economic undertakings. The role of prices was articulated by Mises and Hayek in the Critique of Socialism, but the implications are not merely negative, that socialism doesn't work, but positive. The discipline of law and economics has drawn on the results of that debate to show how legal and political institutions, by providing well-defined and legally secure protection of property, make possible the benefits of prosperity and social harmony. As Hayek noted, coordination among people who may not share common ends is only made possible by exchange of property. Ownership channels the efforts of millions of persons who are unknown to each other into cooperation to produce wealth. Ownership, based on well-defined and legally secure property rights, is the foundation of a society of widespread and growing prosperity. But not everybody understands this. John Kenneth Galbraith wrote a best-selling book in 1958 called The Affluent Society, in which he discussed the phenomenon of, quote, private opulence and public squalor, unquote. That is, he saw a society in which privately owned resources were generally clean, efficient, well-maintained, and improving in quality, while public spaces were dirty, overcrowded, and unsafe. And he concluded, oddly enough, that we ought to move more resources into the public sector, where they would fall victim to squalor. Thousands, hundreds of thousands of college students were assigned to read The Affluent Society, and Galbraith's ideas played a major role in the vast expansion of government during the 1960s and 1970s. But Galbraith and American politicians missed the real point of his observation. The more logical answer is that if privately owned resources are better maintained, we should seek to expand private ownership. There may be some assets that are inevitably government owned. National defense is a good example, and we'd probably better anticipate $600 toilet seats if the government is running national defense. I think that's just a cost of having the inefficiency of government provide a true public good. But where it isn't necessary to have the government in charge of something, Galbraith's observation should lead us to seek to move in that direction toward the private ownership. Private owners tend to take better care of their property because they will reap the benefits of any increase in its value or suffer the consequences if it deteriorates. If you own a home, you are going to be more conscious of whether the roof needs fixing, how the yard looks, keeping it painted, keeping it maintained, because you reap the value of it first because you live there, because you intend to live there for a while, and because you eventually intend, probably, to sell it. Renters generally don't take care of property as well as owners do. That's why many rental agreements require the renter to put down a deposit so that he'll have an incentive too. Privately owned rental apartments are better maintained than public housing because they do have owners. The problem is that no one really owns the public property, and no individual will lose his investment if the value of public property declines. Shoddiness is therefore inherent in government ownership. Tenants in government housing show far less concern for the condition of their homes than tenants in privately rented housing because there's no owner who cares. Most privately owned stores are clean and well lit with friendly, helpful clerks, at least compared with, say, the post office. The Postal Service doesn't seek out rude and indifferent employees. It's just that neither its clerks nor their supervisors have anything to gain by treating customers well. You can see the same phenomena around the world. On a trip to China in 1988, I found shop clerks in Shanghai just as indifferent to their customers as postal workers in the United States. I went back to Shanghai in 1997 and things had changed. People were beginning to learn what it meant to serve customers. But on that same 1988 trip, I also visited the South African township of Soweto, and this was, of course, during the era of apartheid. And in many ways, apartheid, and particularly South Africa's black townships, were the purest form of communism the world had ever seen. The government built the townships where urban blacks were forced to live. It built thousands of small, identical brick houses and assigned people to them with no regard to tribal origin, family relationships, income, or personal preferences. Unlike the residents of a normal town, they could not choose to live near their friends or relatives or people of similar educational or occupational background. Nor, of course, did they have property rights. Not only could a tenant not sell his house, the government could and did take it away from him at will. Naturally, the unfortunate residents of Soweto did not see much point in taking good care of their houses. Shortly before my trip, however, the South African government had quietly begun to allow Sowetans to purchase their homes. And the results were just what one should expect. People began cleaning, painting, and fixing up their houses. Homeowners would buy a wooden door to replace the standard metal one. They would buy decorative windows, put a fence around the yard, even add a room or an upper floor. Buyers generally had to continue living in the houses they already occupied, which would limit the amount of investment you would put into it, and which led to the strange phenomenon of a well-kept, newly enlarged house sitting between two ill-kept government hovels. In a freer market, an affluent homeowner would probably move to a better neighborhood, or someone would buy the houses next door and fix them up. But in Soweto, he could only take advantage of the few options he had to improve his own lot. There was a section of expensive new homes in Soweto. There were a few black people who were able to get rich in the latter days of apartheid, but their money did not free them from the requirement to live in the townships. A visitor could stand in the middle of this impressive new suburban development and look across the road at the government-provided barracks where single men lived under truly appalling conditions. It was a striking example of private versus public property. At the other end of the scale from the impressive new homes were the shanties, built by blacks who migrated to the Johannesburg area because there was work there, but were denied access to government housing. At first, the government bulldozed the shanties, saying that they were illegal squatters. More moderate voices finally persuaded the government that because it was not providing those blacks with housing or allowing them to live outside the townships, it should at least leave the shanties alone. So the shanties were tolerated, but they had no legal right to exist. The residents, therefore, didn't bother to improve them. The government retained the right to expel the occupants or bulldoze the buildings at any time. But inside, there were appliances and televisions for which electricity was supplied by enterprising neighbors. In other words, Galbraith could have found private opulence and public squalor within one small shanty. People spent their money on the things they could own and not on the things they didn't. Another benefit of private property ownership, not so clearly economic, is that it diffuses power. When one entity like the government owns all property, individuals have little protection from the will of the government. The institution of private property, or several property, as it is sometimes called, gives many individuals a place to call their own, a place where they are safe from depredation by others and the state. This is what we mean when we say a man's home is his castle. Private property is essential for privacy and for freedom of the press. Widespread ownership also creates responsible citizens. People who are owners feel more responsibility and more confidence. They feel a stronger stake, not just in their own property, but in their community and their society. Jeff Mulgan is a top aide to Tony Blair, and he explained in a British newspaper not long ago, the left always tended to underestimate the importance of ownership and how hard it is for a democracy that does not have widespread ownership of assets to be truly democratic. To escape from poverty, you need assets. Assets which you can put to work. There is a good deal of historical evidence, as well as abundant contemporary evidence, that ownership tends to encourage self-esteem and healthy habits of behavior, such as acting more for the long term or taking education more seriously, unquote. And that, of course, is the goal Margaret Thatcher had in mind when she set out to privatize Great Britain's public housing. I think a lot of Americans learned the wrong lesson from Thatcher. The public housing Thatcher was trying to privatize, known over there as council housing, was occupied by working people, lower middle class, factory workers, for instance, but people with an income, people with jobs. That made it very different from most public housing in the United States. But Margaret Thatcher's administration sold 1.5 million housing units to their occupants, transforming 1.5 million British families from tenants in public housing to proud homeowners. She thought the housing would be better maintained, but more importantly, she thought that homeowners would become more responsible citizens, that they would see themselves as having a stake in the future and in the quality of life in their communities. And yes, she also thought the homeowners would be more likely to vote for lower taxes and less regulation, policies that would tend to improve the country's economic performance and thus vote for the Conservative Party, or for the Labor Party only when it renounced its traditional socialism. And at least on the latter point, she seemed to have been proved correct. There's a lot of back and forth between the United States and England, obviously always has been, still is. When the co-chairman of the Conservative Party came to America and asked Karl Rove to explain what does the president mean by ownership society, it is reported that Rove read to him from a book called The Anatomy of Thatcherism. So he was reading to the chairman of Conservative Party lines like, the Thatcherite argues that being one's own master in the sense of owning one's own home, or disposing of one's own property provides an incentive to think differently about the world. The Thatcherite stresses that patterns of ownership and moral attitudes are connected and sees in wider individual ownership a means of promoting moral attitudes Thatcherism seeks to cultivate. And I suppose we are intended to understand that Bushism also seeks to cultivate that, at least in this one narrow area of the Bush administration's policies. America already is an ownership society, more so than any other place in the world. The United States today has the most widespread property ownership in history, a historic high of 69% of American households own their own homes. Even more significantly, increasing numbers of Americans are becoming capitalists, people who own a share of productive businesses through stocks or mutual funds. About half of American households qualify as stockholding in some form. That's up from 32% in 1989 and only 19% in 1983, before the Reagan boom. A remarkable change in just 20 years, from about 20% to 50% of American households owning stock, often in mutual funds, pension funds, and so on. That means that almost half of Americans directly benefited from the enormous market appreciation between 1982 and 2000 and are prepared to see their wealth increase again when the market growth resumes. But it also means that about half of Americans are not benefiting as owners from the growth of the American economy. Now, of course, they still benefit as wage earners and consumers. In general, those are Americans below the average income. The best thing we could do to create an ownership society in America is to give more Americans an opportunity to invest in stocks, bonds, and mutual funds so that they too can become capitalists. And the way to do that is obvious, and the president has pointed to it. Every working American is required to set aside 12.4% of his income for retirement, up to $90,000 in income. That's about $5,000 for a working man making $40,000 a year. But that money goes into the Social Security system, where it's used to pay benefits to current retirees. It's not invested in real assets, and it doesn't belong to the wage earner who put the money into that account. If we want to make every working American investor an owner of real assets with control of his own retirement funds and a stake in the growth of the American economy, then we should let workers put their Social Security taxes into private retirement accounts, like IRAs or 401ks. Then, instead of hoping to receive someday a meager retirement income from a Social Security system that every young person knows is headed for bankruptcy, American workers would own their own assets in accounts that couldn't be taken or reduced by Congress. Since Chile began a program like this in 1980, on the same day that Ronald Reagan was elected president, about 25 countries have created private retirement accounts, and today about 100 million workers around the world have opted out, in part or in whole, of their Social Security systems and created private retirement accounts with some of the money that would otherwise have gone into taxes, making 100 million new capitalists around the world. President Bush has talked about such a reform since his first campaign. He created the President's Commission to Strengthen Social Security, and it proposed some ways to achieve this goal. He campaigned for re-election on personal accounts. His opponent, John Kerry, campaigned in another direction, pledging never to allow working-class Americans to invest their savings in stocks and bonds, as his family has done so successfully. Bush launched a renewed effort on this after re-election. He said this was his primary domestic policy objective for his second term. He created a campaign called 60 Speeches in 60 Days, where he did travel around the country talking about this. But those of us who had been working on this for a long time were very frustrated that the president seemed to present this as medicine. Now, it's important to take your medicine when you're sick, but it's not a very appealing message. And in our view, this is a very appealing message. The richest half of Americans are investors. The poorest half of Americans are not. The president actually had a program that would allow all working Americans to become owners, investors, capitalists, And instead, he campaigned on, it's time to take your medicine. We have an unsustainable system. Well, we do have an unsustainable system, and this is one way of sweetening the medicine. But the fact is, I could say you should sell the sizzle, not the steak, but in this case, I think he wasn't even selling the steak. He was selling the antacid. He should have been talking about the opportunity. He should have been talking about ownership, inheritability, and choice. We found that ownership, inheritability, and choice all polled very high when we asked people about it. In fact, they polled higher than you can have more money in retirement. It was the idea that you would own it, you could control it, you could choose whether to do it or not, and you could leave it to your kids. That's what people liked. I'm not sure that we're going to get very far. I do believe that 25 years from now, we will have Social Security choice, but it may not happen immediately. Other reforms that could enhance the ownership society include school choice, which would allow parents to take control of the decision about where their children would attend school, and wider use of health savings accounts, which transfer ownership of your medical care dollars from your employer's insurance company to you. Let me come back finally to the issue of responsibility. Hurricane Katrina showed us the consequences of a lack of responsibility. A few days after Katrina, a major Washington journalist called me and said, "Doesn't the desperate condition of the poor in New Orleans undermine the whole idea of Bush's ownership society?" And I thought, how many ways is that wrong? The suffering visible in the poorest parts of New Orleans was a perfect example of the failure of the non-ownership society. People had become trapped in dependency with neither financial nor moral assets to rely on. The people who suffered the most were the poorest residents of New Orleans, many of them on welfare, the very people the government had lured into decades of dependency. The welfare state had taught generations of poor people to look to government for everything, housing, food, money, you name it. Their sense of responsibility and self-reliance had atrophied. When government failed, they had few resources to fall back on. And there are other failures of non-ownership there as well. Why do people build houses below sea level or in hurricane territory or on fragile barrier islands? Well, one reason is subsidized insurance. It's not their responsibility. Somebody else will pay the consequences. And what about the levees? Property can be owned in many ways. We usually talk about private property and think of individuals or businesses. But property can be held by families, churches, partnerships, other kinds of arrangements, even cities. Why didn't the city of New Orleans take responsibility for its levies? Well, at least partly because it was able to slough off its responsibility onto the federal government, which had many distractions and little incentive to do the job right. Widespread poverty ownership has many benefits for society. It means that property values are better maintained, long-term values are higher, including environmental quality, which is protected by actual owners. It means that people have a greater stake in their community and thus become better citizens. It protects people from the arbitrary power of government and gives them more freedom and more confidence as citizens. And it produces prosperity because markets can't work without private property. The best opportunity right now to encourage more ownership among all Americans is private retirement accounts created as an alternative option to Social Security. Thank you very much.